FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your final bonus episode. I know it's been a long time. We've been doing these bonus episodes in between seasons 11 and 12. We've just had a lot going on, and it's a huge case that we're about to start next week. So I really appreciate the time and the patience that you all have given me and the grace to have some time to get ourselves caught up and do all the traveling we needed to do and get ready to go. So for this last bonus episode, I'm doing right now a Facebook Live, which those in the Facebook chat have determined and agree with me that from now on we'll be doing YouTube Lives for this, because the Facebook platform is kind of a pain in the butt to stream. But what I have for you today is, as promised last week, I have the reply brief from Damien's attorneys replying to the reply that Keith Kressman, district attorney, had filed, trying to stop them from testing the DNA. And as I mentioned, I was told by Steve Braga, Damien's attorney, that this would be a very strong response, and it is very much just that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to break down some highlights from the reply brief, and then I'll be taking some Q&A from the Facebook Live, which for any of you that joined here, again, I want to thank you very much. This is, I'm trying to dig into getting the Season 12 first episode out and ready. And just doing this little Q&A like this I know a lot of you guys like doing it. I like doing it, and it also just saves me a lot of time so I can dig into the meat and potatoes for what we have coming. So that being said, there's going to be a quick little commercial break here, and then we're going to get right into this reply memorandum in support of petition to conduct additional DNA testing in the West Memphis 3 case.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so you guys remember, it was several weeks ago. The quick rundown is we have this whole saga, right, where Keith Kressman said that he was willing to test the evidence in the West Memphis 3 case. Then he said the evidence was destroyed. Then after Damien sued them, they miraculously found the evidence. Then he told them, well, you need to file the petition with the court. They did that. And then Kressman came back and wrote this long reply, basically trying to make it sound like it was absolutely asinine and stupid for Damien to be even asking for this DNA testing. And one of the first things that he did was say that they made a fatal error because they filed it in the wrong court to begin with, which shows you just how sharp Keith Kressman is as I break all of this down for you. So I have this 11-page response from Damien's attorneys, Patrick Benka. I'm not going to read you the 11-page response, but I've got some stuff highlighted here to give you kind of the breakdown. I know there were some people that had some concerns when I read to you, I broke down the state's response, because they did make it seem like this was an insane thing for Damien to even be asking for. Well, I think this is going to make you feel a little bit better. So let me just read to you the opening statement of this written by Damien's attorneys. I'll read it verbatim. Relying on erroneous facts, hiding behind strained theories of law, and ironically citing evidentiary preservation obligations, the prosecuting attorney himself had to personally disclaim the state has now finally indicated for the first time after years of discussion that it, quote, cannot agree to the court granting Echols' request to test certain evidence in the case with new DNA technology. So what he's saying here is after all of the time where they said they would do the testing, if we only knew where the evidence was, we would do the testing. That's been going on since 2018. And this is the first time now that they're saying, that, that Cressman is saying, well, now that we have it, now we just can't allow this to happen. The way the document is set up is it goes through the state's arguments one by one, each point, and counters them. And so the very first argument that the state made was the place of conviction. The document says, the prosecuting attorney argues that the petition contains, quote, a fatal error because it was not filed in the court in which the conviction was entered. And from what you'll see here, Cressman did zero homework before filing this response. Moving down a little bit, it says here, this is simply false. As any review of the case record would reveal, the 2011 Alford plea proceedings resulted in the Craighead County convictions being vacated and replaced with the Alford plea convictions in Crittenden County. The state's opening argument thus falls completely flat. So that's point one. Don't think anybody can argue that Damien's team wins that one, because literally, Cressman's just wrong about what court it was filed in. And you almost wonder, did he mail in the rest of the argument because, or the reply, because he figured doesn't matter anyway because it's in the wrong court? If that's the case, he screwed up pretty bad. So the second point was the completion of Eccles' sentence. I've highlighted here, the prosecuting attorney next argues that to allow a non-prisoner to seek relief would make the habeas corpus statute absurd. Damien's team replies, this conclusion is based on the flawed assumption that the only consequence that matters from a conviction is its sentence, which is contrary, in fact, to, as cited here, the Supreme Court that says there are many disabilities or burdens which may flow from a defendant's conviction that give him a substantial stake in the judgment of conviction which survives the satisfaction of the sentence imposed on him. Now, I'm not a lawyer. That was kind of legalese, but basically they're saying that a defendant still has a reason to fight his conviction even after they've already served their sentence. That comes down from the Supreme Court. So I don't know how Cressman thinks he can make that argument, but the case law is very, and they cite other case law in here too. It's very clear that that's not a valid argument. There is no restriction that says you can't file habeas corpus because you're done with your sentence already. That's ridiculous. And then the next segment, number three on the state's part, was they argue the timeliness of the petition. It says the prosecuting attorney relies upon a statutory presumption that deems this petition, quote, presumptively untimely because it was filed more than 36 months after conviction. Now, that's the one I told you guys way back before any of this was even filed, was kind of the non-argument. They kept saying, well, if they really wanted to do it, they only had 36 months to file it. First of all, and it is explained in here, as I explained to you, the law doesn't say they have to request DNA testing within 36 months of a conviction. It says that if they do, then it's presumed timely, meaning the state can't argue that it's not. After 36 months, then, of course, an argument can be made, and that can be decided by a judge. But they, again, made the same argument as though it was one of the nons on Facebook saying that, well, it can't even happen because they were past 36 months. Damien's lawyers continue, but it should be obvious to any readers of Eccles' petition that it is premised on statutory grounds that allow that presumption to be rebutted upon showing that a new method of technology is substantially more probative than prior testing available. They go on to say, the new method of technology detailed in Eccles' petition makes this timeliness argument a complete red herring. So essentially, the timeliness argument, per the Arkansas law, says if there's new technology that can test the evidence that is more probative than the technology that was available at the time of conviction, then timeliness doesn't matter anymore. It's kind of the clock's reset, so to speak. And so as they say, that entire argument's just a red herring. The fourth topic says scientific support for the new technology. And this part's interesting. It says, the prosecuting attorney seeks to convert the statutory test described above, that the new method of technology is substantially more probative than prior testing, into two subsets. One being whether the new technology is a generally accepted scientific method of testing, and the other, whether the new technology violates the requirement that physical evidence in violent offense cases must be preserved. I'll just continue reading here because it's very good. The way it's written is very good. Banker writes, he shifts the goalpost in this regard. Of course, because the new MVEC technology so clearly meets the statutory test. Indeed, the very purpose of this new technology is to have its collection system extract DNA that would not be collected by prior DNA technology. Obviously, new DNA evidence to test is, quote, substantially more probative than none. Because that's what we had before regarding these ligatures was no DNA. And now we want to use a method that can get a whole bunch of DNA. So certainly that would be considered more probative than nothing. Behnke goes on to attack the next point made by the state, which is generally accepted scientific testing method. So the prosecuting attorney contends that the instant petition should be denied because Eccles has not established that MVAC uses scientifically sound methods consistent with accepted forensic practices. So you remember in the reply brief from the state that I read a few weeks ago that he said he did a search of case law, and there was only two cases where it's mentioned, where MVAC is mentioned, and it's not scientifically accepted. Well, listen how Behnke just rips him to shreds here. In order to make this point, the state has to completely ignore the landmark research study that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, conducted on the MVAC technology as reported on page 9 of Eccles' petition. He didn't even need to research the study that's been done. It was part of Eccles' petition. He put the study in the petition where he asked for the DNA to be tested, and that was ignored by Cressman. It goes on to say, amazingly, despite the FBI's status as the top forensic agency and laboratory in the country, the state's response nowhere even mentions the FBI's analysis of this new technology. And here it gets really good. Quote, this court deserves better than that. And accordingly, we provide the online link to the FBI's research study for the court's own review. The reply continues. In addition to ignoring the FBI, the state's response also fails to utter a single word about the MVAC laboratory accreditation information that is also recited in Eccles' petition. Tellingly, the information reveals that the MVAC laboratory is accredited to the same level of forensic standard, which is ISO IEC 17025:2017. It's the same forensic standard as the Arkansas State Crime Laboratory. Literally, the MVAC lab, Pure Gold Forensics, where we want to send this evidence to be tested, has the exact same forensic accreditation as the Arkansas State Crime Lab. And Cressman just forgot to mention that in his brief where he said it's not an accepted science. Behnke continues, the prosecuting attorney advises that his, quote, general case law research reveals only two cases in which courts mention MVAC, end quote. Even if accurate, this case count is hardly surprising in this case because it is a new technology. And precisely because of its newness, you wouldn't expect it to be mentioned in a whole lot of cases. There's also a footnote on this page at the bottom that says significantly the level of accreditation that Pure Gold Forensics has is the same level of certification as Virginia's Bode Technology Laboratory, which is the lab that did all the other DNA testing on this case back in 2007. And another footnote says that their general research to date, they've been informed of cases in Maryland, Florida, Georgia, California, Utah, Colorado, Washington, and Texas that have all accepted MVAC processed evidence. A couple more than just the two that Cressman was able to find. So then Behnke goes on to cite the evidence from one of the cases where Cressman had said there were two cases that mentioned MVAC, and one of them there it had to do with DNA evidence that was extracted from a pillowcase. And I'll read the quote out of the reply brief here. Behnke writes, the scientific reliability of the MVAC system was therefore at the very heart of this appeal, which ultimately affirmed the technology's use and the defendant's conviction. So there's a whole lot there I'm not reading to you, but the defendant appealed based on the scientific acceptability, I guess, of the MVAC technology and the case cited by Cressman, and the court upheld the conviction and said that it was, in fact, sound science. Then that's one of the cases that Cressman used to argue against its reliability. Now we get into the preservation of physical evidence. Remember, Cressman said that you couldn't test the DNA because if you test the DNA, you're going to alter the evidence. And you know that, you know, we're supposed to preserve this evidence, so you can't alter it, which is silly, right? I mean, that means like you can't test any DNA. And also, he's one to talk about preserving evidence. Well, we're not the only ones that share that view. Balbanka kind of feels the same way. So let me read you some of this about the preservation of physical evidence. I love this line. This is my favorite line of the whole thing. Banka writes, having been educated by Eccles' counsel on the state's obligation to preserve evidence for future DNA testing, the prosecuting attorney now suggests that MVAC, quote, isn't a viable testing method because it, quote, cleans physical evidence through its wet vacuum collection process, which rather than preserving physical evidence is a one-shot deal that forever alters it, end quote. Okay, so before we move on there, did you guys catch the snarky bit in there that having been educated by Damien's attorneys, now the state understands its obligation? So someone was commenting on my grin when I was reading that bit. So just to back that up, just in case you missed it, what is Damien's lawyers wrote is that Cressman had to learn through the lawsuit that Damien filed when he said he destroyed the evidence that he's supposed to preserve it. And now he is the champion of preserving evidence all of a sudden. Even though I actually was the reason I was a little late on this live stream today, because I was talking to a reporter who was one of the ones that broke the whole story about the destroying evidence. I think he's going to be on our follow-up next week. Cressman told him in April of last year that he was trying to get a court order to allow him to destroy that evidence while he was telling Damien's team that they were allowed to test it. But now he's worried about it altering the evidence and not preserving it. I'll move on. It is a matter of scientific fact, of course, that any testing of evidence for DNA alters the physical evidence to some degree. And it goes on to explain how DNA testing alters evidence. And I'll pick it back up here. The Arkansas DNA statute's preservation obligation has to allow for this degree of evidentiary alteration through the testing process, or else there would never be any DNA testing ever, turning the statute into a wholly meaningless enactment. Fortunately, this case does not require the court to calibrate too precisely what degree of evidentiary alteration might be affected by the MVAC technology. And I have it all highlighted, but I'll just kind of give you the Reader's Digest here. He says there's six bindings, and there are two knots on every piece of binding. And since we have no reason to believe that the killer would have interacted with any one of those knots differently than the others, the court can just decide how many of the knots that they will allow for this round of testing. Meaning they can say, well, we don't want to destroy any evidence that's there, so instead of testing all 12 knots, let's test 4 knots and see if we get anything. And then you would suspect that if say you test 4 knots and you find somebody's DNA in 2, 3 or all 4 of them, then the state might say, okay, well, let's do a little more testing on more knots. But they can easily preserve the evidence, and if they test, say, 4 of the knots and leave 8 of the knots, then there's no reason to believe that the other eight knots wouldn't have the same level of DNA or evidence on them, because there's no indication that the killer acted any differently with one knot than the other. Nick is making fun of me for saying Reader's Digest. I feel like there are some people in here that are old enough, like me, to get the reference, Nick. Maybe you're too. Are you too young for that? Or are you up here with me? I'll move on. We'll come back to that. The next point is the impact of the proposed testing of new evidence. The prosecuting attorney's final argument is that the jury was presented with the substantial evidence of guilt, and that given this trial evidence, another person's DNA at the crime scene wouldn't prove that the defendant was innocent. This position is a repetition of the same mistake the state made in its hearing of Eccles' case before the Arkansas Supreme Court. So I'm not going to go through and read all of this, but essentially this is the same argument made back in 2007, the hearings before that, for the last time that Damien's team was trying to get DNA tested. And that, you know, they said that, well, just because they find somebody else's DNA there, that's not going to make them innocent. And essentially, the Supreme Court disagreed with that. So they not only have like a precedent to look back upon, but they have a precedent in this case. Like, he's literally making the exact same argument that the Supreme Court shot down before and remanded the case back to the circuit court, which is where it ultimately ended up in the Alford plea. Another thing that the state's arguing there is that they're trying to twist the case law from the Supreme Court and say that even if someone else's DNA is found at the crime scene, that DNA has to be tested against or has to be compared or lumped in with all of the evidence that the jury heard that indicates that Damian, Jason, and Jesse are guilty. But that's not exactly what it says. I'm not a lawyer enough to quite understand it, but they're saying, no, they're just saying you have to take all of the evidence in consideration together. It doesn't say the DNA evidence has to overpower the guilty evidence if it's exculpatory DNA. But that's all a little above my pay grade, so to speak. All right, so we're already 20 minutes into this, and I know the chat's going crazy. I got a bunch of questions that I want to answer. So I'll make sure that I publish this document on our website so you can read the rest. Mostly it just concludes. I will read this first paragraph of the conclusion, though. I think it kind of sums things up. It says, the prosecuting attorney nominally recognizes that he is a, quote, minister of justice and shouldn't oppose a post-trial motion without a reasonable basis. That's Cressman's own quote. But his concluding points in support of that premise demonstrate nothing but the unreasonableness of his position here. The fact that the defendant was imprisoned and now he's free is wholly unrelated to the question of Echols' guilt or innocence. It is a pure non sequitur. Likewise, the claim that the proposed testing would forever alter the physical evidence is simply false. As discussed above, appropriately defining the parameters of the proposed testing moots the issue entirely. And finally, the statutory change making the DNA testing law more stringent is a soundbite without substance. More stringent or not, the new standard requiring petitioner to advance a theory of defense that it established actual innocence would certainly be satisfied by DNA results identifying a third-party perpetrator as the individual who bound the child victims with their sneaker-laced ligatures on the night they were murdered. No credible minister of justice would even think of ignoring the power of such potential evidence. And that, so I did skip something that I want to circle back to real quick. Okay, so regarding what was just said there, which was that no one could ignore that evidence. If there's evidence of another person in those bindings, then that can't be ignored. You can't just say, well, that's not enough to overturn the conviction. That's bullshit. You know it. I know it. So does Cressman. And what was on the previous page, I skipped past this because as you can see on YouTube Live, it's like a whole page. But I'll sum it up for you. The Banca gives a hypothetical here. After first explaining that clearly that evidence would be very meaningful if you found that evidence, DNA in the ligatures. And he gives this hypothetical. He says, a simple hypothetical will illustrate the difference of these types of evidence. On one hand, we have a gun that is found at a murder scene where the victim was not shot. And on the other hand, we have a gun that is found at a murder scene where the victim was shot. In the first situation, DNA from the gun might be characterized as being simply another person's DNA at the crime scene, which is the language that Cressman used in his response. However, in the second situation, DNA from the gun must be more logically characterized as being the DNA of the killer. The ligatures fall squarely into the second situation because we know that the killer or killers used them in the commission of these crimes. Why is it so hard for the prosecuting attorney to see or perhaps to admit that Echols' petition presents a real new technology opportunity to obtain the biological fingerprints of the killer or killers, whoever that might be? All right. So the chat was going crazy while I was reading all of that. So I might try to scroll back through some of that, but now I'm looking at the camera ready to answer your questions. I'm reading some up there now in the Facebook chat. So we'll do a little Q&A here before we wrap things up. So Erica says, assuming things finally go forward and testing of the ligatures takes place, what happens if they get no usable DNA at all, or if they get, once again, DNA from a parent or step-parent? Will the other items be able to then be tested? So obviously those are options. If there's no DNA found, this case will probably be a mystery forever. I don't think that there's anything else we're going to have down the road that will be any give us a better shot than this MVAC testing. If it comes back to be apparent, so there's a difference between, we have the one hair that is attributed to Hobbs, but we got to be clear, we don't know that that's Terry Hobbs' hair. There's a hair that is the mitochondrial DNA profile. Terry Hobbs can't be eliminated from it. That hair was found in the binding. And actually, there's been a lot of debate about that, but it's actually cited in this case law that says it was in Michael Moore's binding. So wrapped up in Michael Moore's binding in the knot was a hair that may or may not belong to Terry Hobbs, but he can't be eliminated from it. The state's able to argue there that that could be transfer. We know Michael Moore was in Terry Hobbs' house that day, and there could be a hair floating around. We have to believe, because keep in mind, it's not like the boy's shoes were just tied. So say that hair got somehow wrapped up into the knot when Michael tied his shoes when he left the house. The killer untied their shoes, pulled the laces all the way through all the eyelets. Think about completely removing laces from a shoe. Then retied knots in a new place, right? So it's not where they were tied when they were tied as a shoelace, but now they're tied as bindings. And the hair stuck in there. So they can make the argument that it was transfer hair that he picked up just from being in his house. But what do you think the odds are that a hair that got onto the lace in that scenario made it through a whole day of playing, riding a bike, being untied, pulled through all the eyelets, and then retied and still ends up just visible sticking out of the new knots? But to answer your question, if they find, say, a parent or step-parent's DNA in the knots, it would depend on how many, right? So say, and it would depend, you know, I guess if they're alibied, you know, for example, Pam Hobbs was at work. So if you find her DNA in there, you could certainly, well, she probably tied Stevie's shoe. Her DNA might be on those laces. But what you wouldn't expect is her DNA to be found on more than Stevie's laces, right? So you might see her DNA on one or two of the knots. You shouldn't see it on all of them. We tend to believe that the killer's DNA will be found in all of the knots. I mean, there's a high likelihood. If the evidence is preserved well enough, it's hard to tie a knot without shedding skin cells into it. The water may have washed some of it away, but so it just depends. So anybody's DNA that's found in, say, all 12 knots, that's a killer. Plain and simple. There's no getting around it. Chris says, what is the time required to complete MVAC testing? A day, a month, a week? Isn't how long does the physical process take? I was told when I was at Pure Gold that they could probably turn it around for us in a couple of weeks. That they could get a lot of times your issues with long times to get DNA testing done. A lot of times those issues are due to backlog that, you know, there's just too many. They're waiting to get tested. But I was told that, they could get it in, get it MVAC'd, get it tested, and get results within a couple of weeks. Beth says, Bob, this is my second live with you. Please tell Mike that he will be missed and congratulations on his new job. I will definitely do that. Actually, he's going to hear that right now. So there you go, Mike, as you're editing this. Beth says she misses you and congrats on your new job and your night gig where you, after doing work all day, still edit these podcasts for us. We love you, buddy. Corinne says, if somehow nothing comes up on the knots, can they do the sticks next? Or does that require another filing? It would require another filing from the court. I would think that there's probably less of likelihood of finding DNA on the stick. There's more likelihood of DNA being put onto the sticks because they were jagged and they were pushed down in the mud, but they were under flowing water the entire time. So I don't know. I mean, I think they would certainly try again for that, but you know, the knots are hopefully our best bet. Nick says, would you think a stepdad would have actually tied a friend's shoes? That's anecdotal, so it doesn't matter what I think. I mean, I'm a stepdad. When my daughter was little, my stepdaughter was little, I'm sure I tied a friend's shoe here and there. I don't know. The thing is, Terry wasn't home that day. Like Terry says, he never saw any of the kids. We know he wasn't home when Michael Moore was or Chris Byers were at his house earlier that day. So the only argument there is that one of his hairs was just floating around and got caught up into Michael's shoelaces. Heather says, back to preservation of evidence. Why didn't you say that MVAC still preserves it? The filter can be tested multiple times. Yeah, so they didn't make that argument. I would have. I don't know that they quite understand it yet, but I think they made a good enough point anyway. And so what Heather's talking about here is, as I described, so with MVAC, instead of just having a little swab, it collects all the evidence onto a disc about the size of, say, a 50-cent piece, a half dollar, and they only cut like a small piece of that off to test it and still preserve the rest of it. But I'm sure that argument could be made later, but I don't think it's even necessary. Danielle says, I believe you may have mentioned it before, but how many testing samples can they get out of the collection filter? As many as that. I mean, they can cut it. Think of a pizza. You know, see, I just made a frozen pizza for my son before I came down here today for dinner. And somebody asked about my puppy earlier. We're missing our pizza cutter. So I had to cut it with a knife. I'm pretty sure Mac took that outside. But anyway, you know, you can cut it. You can make that piece of pizza into 4 slices. You can make it into 8 slices. You can make it into 6 slices. It's the same thing with that disc. I believe that Susanna told me when I was there that, I don't want to speak for her, but I feel like I remember her saying that they typically will like cut it into quarters and try testing just one quarter at a time and save 3/4 of it, I believe. But I remember her showing me that they'll still save the majority of it, or the overwhelming majority of it, when they do the testing. Susanna wants to know, do you think that if it is Terry, that they'll arrest him? I would certainly hope that if there is evidence found, that clear and convincing evidence of who murdered those boys, that the police would arrest them. Yeah, I certainly hope so. So if it's a situation where, I don't want to speak about like Terry, I don't want to say that because it could be anybody. I'm not suggesting that it's Terry. But let's say they find compelling evidence. If it's enough to exonerate, if the evidence is compelling enough to exonerate the West Memphis Three, then it should be, it will be plenty enough to make an arrest. I think at that point, if they don't, the DOJ will, I mean, somebody will get somebody to do something. But I don't think that if a court says this evidence is clear and convincing evidence of the actual innocence of these three, if a judge says that, And the evidence that is the clear and convincing evidence is that somebody else's fucking skin cells are under every single ligature of these boys. I want to believe, nothing would surprise me, but I want to believe that even Keith Kressman or whoever the prosecutor is in the West Memphis Police Department would finally say, okay, we fucked up, and go make the arrest. I hope. Beth says, with all this back and forth with the lawyer and the prosecutors, can they retry the boys? No, because as of now, they are already convicted. So it would be double jeopardy to take them back and try them for murder again. They can't do that. They've already literally been convicted and completed their sentence. The only way that could happen, and it wouldn't, I don't think it's ever happened, but it could happen, is if some sort of evidence came up to where the court ordered the conviction vacated, but it wasn't an exoneration on actual innocence. But they can, then technically they're not convicted again. In that case, technically the prosecutor could say, well, now I'm going to take him back to trial again, which would give them the opportunity to prove their evidence, their innocence, or maybe give them an opportunity to go back to prison again. I mean, it would be a mess. That would never happen. But no, right now they're pretty safe because they're out. You know, it would be a disaster for their lives if, you know, that's why, you know, I mean, the evidence is why I believe so strongly in Damian, Jason, and Jesse's innocence. But beyond that, you know, people said, well, they can't go back to prison. Even if they find their DNA, they're just like, whatever. Think what that would do for their lives, their careers. They would be the most hated people in this country. And they'd probably get murdered, to be honest with you, if that happened. Something would happen. But yeah, I mean, they are able to squeak out a living even with these felony murder convictions on their record, mostly because there's a lot of people out there that support them and believe they're innocent. If that wasn't the case, then I don't know what they'd be able to do. Chris says, in Damien's tweet of the evidence, I only see one bike. How many are in evidence? I believe they're both in evidence. There might have just only been one in that picture, but I believe they have both bikes. Joshua says, please tell Mike, quote, how dare you leave, expletive, expletive, expletive. And then he says, just kidding, buddy. Congrats and good luck. Matt says, I would love to know what Jamie Ballard has to say now. I would too. I tried to interview her for the documentary, and one of the producers talked to her, and she didn't want to be interviewed. I was actually just talking about that too with the gentleman who will hopefully, George Jared is his name, that I'm hoping to have on. So we don't have Janet next week for the follow-up, or this week. It'll be, you know, this week, Wednesday. So it's just me and Zach. But I think what I might do, kind of flip-flop, because this is kind of a Q&A, so then I might just do an interview for the follow-up with George. But we were talking a little bit about that too, because he was one of the ones. So this dude was around, like, all the stuff that you saw in West of Memphis. He actually reported on all that stuff in the Jonesboro newspaper before it happened, before you saw it on the documentary. He's been there the whole time. And I was just telling him, we were talking about some of the conflicts that I found with that statement, and I don't really know what to think about it. So we may have a longer discussion on that if he's on this week. Rena says, it could very well be someone we never even considered, and that would be pretty conclusive. Oh, for sure. Say you find, you know, I mean, an ideal scenario would be you find a good DNA profile under multiple bindings, and you throw it into CODIS and find out it's some known child murderer from another case or something. There's case. I mean, that would be easy, right? That would be the easiest thing in the world to close this thing. It's more complicated if it ends up being a family member. Kate says, why is the evidence not being moved to a more secure location? Clearly, these fools can't be trusted. I couldn't agree more, but it's supposed to be in the secure location, right? It's the police department evidence room. So, I don't, and we don't have possession of it. That's what we're trying to get. That's what all this is about, is to get possession of it to do testing. So we definitely don't have the right to tell them to put it somewhere. But, you know, at least we know where it is. So if it's not there when we go back, then they're going to have a big problem. Erica says, I'm worried that Cressman may have a voodoo doll with your name on it, Bob. You know he has to go to bed at night cursing your name. Probably. I know Cressman's not a fan. I don't know about, Ellington's not a fan. I'm not so sure about Cressman, but I'm sure he knows that I cause these problems for him. Well, actually, you guys cause these problems for him. Rena says, because of precedence, we are pretty sure the testing will be done, right? I think so. I mean, I was a little concerned when I saw the state's response, because, you know, I don't know the law. And so when I see a response that says, you stupid idiots, you filed your request in the wrong court, and that makes the whole thing moot. And what are, I mean, he literally was like, you're a stupid idiot for filing this, because obviously you can't do DNA testing after 36 months, and obviously you can't do habeas when somebody's already served their sentence. So there was a little concern there, but after seeing this response, when it was like, I mean, essentially this is 11 pages of, that was the dumbest legal argument I've ever seen in my entire life. Do you even lawyer, bro? Is like pretty much what this says. So yeah, I'm feeling very confident in it, especially when they're citing the Supreme Court law that's from this case itself from years past. I feel pretty good about it. Josh says, wouldn't that be double jeopardy? I'm assuming you're talking about what I said earlier. So in the scenario that I described earlier, where there was a way that they could be tried again, which was if like the conviction is vacated, then the prosecuting attorney could try them again. In that case, it would not be double jeopardy, because if the conviction is vacated, it's a reset, like the trial never happened, which would allow them to try them again. Can they end back the knife that was pulled out of Jason's pond? No, I mean, they could, but that's silly. That whole knife situation is silly to begin with. There were multiple witnesses in the police file who told them the reason they knew the knife was there because they saw Jason throw the knife into that pond a year before the murder. So, like, it's nonsense, that knife. Get out of here with that knife. Lily says, is money a factor in the testing? And if so, could we raise it? Yeah. I mean, we better, because I told all of this, all these filings are premised on my promise to Damien's legal team that if they get the opportunity to test the evidence, that between myself personally and my audience, we will fund the testing. So they do not need to worry about how to come up with the money for the testing that we'll raise it. And also Jillian Pensavalli, who's a good friend of mine, good friend of the show, and good friend of Damien's as well, has from True Crime Obsessed, has joined that and said she is committed to making sure it happens too. So yeah, we'll make sure it happens. Kathy says they're looking forward to seeing me and Zach in Vegas. Me too. I'm ready to go. I'm excited about it. It's going to be a busy week for me. I'm doing not one, but two presentations on the West Memphis 3 with two different guests, which is going to be, and they're both going to be, if you don't have tickets to CrimeCon yet, at least get a virtual, because it's going to be bananas. There's going to be some craziness happening at CrimeCon. It's going to be something. And so is the live show in Grand Rapids on April 16th. So get tickets to that too. They're super cheap compared to CrimeCon. So Suzanne's asking, we were talking about Jamie Ballard. Who's Jamie? She's the one that came forward 2007, and says that she saw the boys playing in her backyard. They darted out between her house and the next house on their bikes. And she saw Terry Hobbs come out yelling at the boys to get back here, which was a huge thing. It was in the west of Memphis. It was kind of a big deal. And I'd like to believe it because not that I have any beef with Hobbs, but it's like, it at least gives us a clear direction. Oh, something crazy else happened. But the more we picked at that story, it was like, there's seven people that say the boys were somewhere else when that happened. So it's hard to believe. Also, 14 years had gone by before she came forward. So she's probably trying to tell the truth. I just think maybe she doesn't quite remember it correctly. Corrine says, blame the ship captain for not having Janet next week. Yeah, anybody that was on Patreon or the live stream today knows that Janet was actually going, she's on a cruise for some kind of convention for the work she does. Her main job is all of her voice acting work. And she was going to ask the ship captain if they could try to make a port day on Wednesday so she could get some good internet. I told her not to do that because that's silly. Josh asks, was there any investigation into the Bojangles chicken guy? The whole situation seems weird. And right around the time everything was happening. No, I mean, I looked both on the podcast and the documentary. I think the Bojangles thing is a red herring. I mean, it seems like, bloody man walking into a restaurant at the same time these boys are missing. It's possible, but there's nothing to investigate. Meek never went in. Regina Meek never went into the restaurant. We don't know who the dude is. They took blood samples, and was a Detective Ridge lost the blood sample. There's nothing we can do. Literally, I mean, it's not like there's evidence we can test to find out who that dude is. It's gone. All right, so we're coming up on, looks like we're about 45 minutes into this. So we're going to take a few more questions. Don McElhinney, who I like to call Doug, says, Doug says you're buying the beer when he gets to Vegas for CrimeCon. I suppose for years of getting your name wrong, Doug, I'd be happy to buy you one cheap beer. And I'll have an expensive whiskey at the time. Erica says, any communication with Jesse or Jason? Is that a problem if they aren't listed in the petitions? Not a problem. And I've not had contact with Jesse. Nobody really has. He's hard to find. I mean, he doesn't even have a phone. You got to pretty much go to the trailer park and then figure out which trailer he's staying in. Every time I've talked to him, Jason. Yeah, I talked to Jason today, as a matter of fact, and yesterday. Yeah. And he's fully on board with what's happening. It was too complicated and taking too long to get lawyers from everybody to get together and agree on a motion. So Damien's team just said, listen, well, what we know is we want to do the testing. And he also knows Jason's in support of the testing. You guys all saw that in the documentary. So they just banged it out and sent it. Beth says, is there any chance it could have been a serial killer? Just curious. There's a chance of everything. I don't think so. There's just nothing at that crime scene to indicate that it was a serial killer. Everything to me looks like it was a crime of opportunity, personal cause homicide that, probably, I think something got out of hand with one kid. The other two were witnesses. They got killed. Then everything else we see that was ritualistic was just simply disposing of the bodies. No one would plan to kill somebody in that place. The way it's kind of depicted in like the Devil's Knot movie, it looks like this big secluded place, but it's not. I mean, it's like the size of a football field woods where you could see houses over there and a truck stop there and a highway there right through the, finding yourself in that spot with three dead bodies is a big, 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 big problem. And so, whoever did it figured under the water was the best method. Personally, I think they probably tried to push the boys underwater and their clothes were catching current and floating them up. So I think they probably pulled them out, stripped them off, stripped the clothes off, used their shoelaces to bind them up, make kind of a smaller package, wrap sticks around them, jam them down under the water, and got out of there. And on everything there shows that this is a personal cause homicide. This is someone with a known personal relationship with at least one of the victims. Because of their age, it would be some kind of an authority figure to at least one of them, which in the case of eight-year-olds, it could just be any adult could do that. The fact, the way the bodies were concealed says that tells me that this person thinks, at least thinks, that people know that he was with those boys. The type of concealment that was done here, to me, indicates this person knows if those bodies are found, they're going to immediately look at me because I must have been out in the open or somewhere around these boys. I don't know if anybody saw me, so it's imperative that the bodies not be found. None of that is indicative of a serial killer, like a random person, because it actually is a good place to kill somebody for a serial killer. You can park a semi right there at the Blue Beacon. You could kill the boys and just, so if no one had any, this is 1993, right? Nobody knows about DNA. There's no touch DNA. There's none of that. The boys weren't sexually assaulted. There's no motive there for that. It was just some serial killer. First, the problem is, how would you ever possibly know there would be kids in that spot? That's silly. It's not a place you would find kids. So I believe very strongly somebody followed them there from the neighborhood. But let's just say that, there's a truck-driving serial killer at the Blue Beacon. Hears the voices of little kids down in that little woody patch. And they decide, here's an opportunity for me to fulfill my urge to kill little children. And they go down there and they kill them. Well, they would kill them and then leave. They would never, ever, no one would ever spend the amount of time that it would take with those bodies to get them undressed and bound and hide all that evidence. That entire time you're sitting there with three dead children. So if you don't have any connection to those children, and you killed them for the sake of killing them, which is what a serial killer maybe would do, you're just going to get the hell out of there. Like, literally, go up the hill, get in your truck, drive away. It's 1993. There's no cell phones to track. There's no GPS data. There's no touch DNA. As soon as you get in the truck and hit that highway, you're in the clear. You would never spend that much time with those bodies. It was too big of a risk. The behaviors at this crime scene are what tells us this is somebody with a known personal relationship to those boys. And with that, I'll maybe answer one more, and then I really got to get going. Mostly because it's going to be a long episode for Mike to edit. Michelle says, as a New Englander, she approves of my get out of here. Yeah, I was pretty happy about that myself. Oh, and actually Lilia says, as an Italian-American New Englander, she also approves. So I did it pretty well. Looking for one more question. Andrea says, I bought tickets to your Michigan meetup for my husband and myself. We are so excited to meet you finally. I'm super excited to meet you too, Andrea, plus any of the rest of you that are going to be there. Hey, Tank, I see you just joined. Good to see you too. Tank's been with this case for a long time, but I got a roll. Seems like the double call tells me there's some sort of an emergency happening, and we're already running up on an hour. But thank you, all of you who joined the Facebook Live. Thank you to all of you listeners who have put up with these bonus episodes for these past couple of months. This Friday's follow-up will probably be an interview, or it could just be me and Zach. We might do another live. I love doing these with you guys. And for those of you that weren't on the live, hope you're enjoying this. And next Sunday, it's finally happening. Season 12, Episode 1, coming at you in 1 week.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support.
If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Murb Gaming. MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all-new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.